They thought like I thought. They drank like I drank. They did what I did. They felt like I felt, and they got better. And for the first time in my entire life, I believed maybe, just maybe, I can get better too.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode 0 on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hey, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on and having this conversation with me.
Angela, it's an absolute pleasure.
We've known each other for about 4 minutes now, and I feel like we are old souls.
Fast friends and old souls, Angela. Right. That's a fact.
So let's start with, tell everybody a little bit about you and what you do.
Sure. So my name is Charlie Lavore. I am a person in long-term recovery. My recovery date is December 6, 2014. What that means to me is that I have not found it necessary to use mood-altering substances since that magical date, December 6, 2014. And I've had the privilege now for 7 years and counting of hosting. I created and now host, along with Jason Rudin, the Way Out podcast. We share powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics to inspire and inform people's recovery. And that's just been an absolute blessing in essentially every way for my recovery.
Amen. What made you decide to do a podcast? Like, what was your journey to get to podcasting?
I love this question, Angela, because it's kind of a two-parter for me. The first piece and the first motivation was when I came into the rooms and into recovery this last time, my third attempt at recovery at 36 years old, I finally had surrendered and really started listening to people's stories. And they started to really change me in profound ways, in a way that I could have never expected or anticipated. And for the first time, I was hearing my story in other people's stories. They thought like I thought. They drank like I drank. They did what I did. They felt like I felt, and they got better. And for the first time in my entire life, I believed maybe, just maybe, I can get better too. And that was a beginning for me of a really profound transformation. And I only started to have that mustard seed of belief that maybe I could get better because of those people's stories. And so it occurred to me that these stories needed to get out of church basements into a more accessible format, because not everybody's going to find their way into a recovery meeting for various reasons. So if I could help elevate these stories so that more people could hear them, maybe we could help some more people get better. That was the first piece. The second piece was, in my first two attempts at recovery, I waxed poetically about recovery principles and practices that I really had no intention on working. And so I talked a big recovery game, Angela. And I wasn't super interested in what you had to say. I was really focused on what I was going to say. And so it was a bit of an amend, too, to my first two attempts at recovery and how could I be of service and elevate other people's stories instead of wax ad nauseum about myself.
Which anyone that has sat in any 12-step meeting can relate to that really well.
We can intimately relate.
Yes, yes.
The recovery power share.
Okay, I love this. What? I'm trying to think of the best way to ask this question because you are very respectful of the principles. But I'm just going for it. And I'm going to give you a little premise where this is coming from. When I got sober, city meetings, at first I wasn't aware of all of the chatter in the world necessarily about sort of the secrecy of the program, right? And right. It's that, you know, you don't talk about the program, press, radio, television, that sort of thing, with good reason, right? Because it can be damaging and it can definitely change people's thoughts about the program before they ever really know anything about it. So I do understand. At the same time, I felt like it was so freaking cool. And yeah. It made me sad that people thought it was so weird. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't we speak more openly about how freaking amazing this is instead of letting all these people think that it's weird or that we're doing something weird in here, when the truth is, like, we're the same idiots that you were drunk with at the bar. We just sit in a different room now and we drink coffee, but we're the same people, right? So I was like, yeah, I don't know why it's shrouded in such weirdness. And so that was kind of my thing of, like, I want to tell everybody about this because it's one of the greatest experiences of my life. I want people to know how amazing it is and the change that it can create. And it doesn't cost anything. And it's just phenomenal, right? So what were your thoughts around the we don't talk about it?
Yeah, the first rule of Fight Club is
you don't talk about Fight Club. Now, what they were doing was weird in Fight Club, by the way.
That's true. In their defense, that was super weird. So it's a great question. And I think it might be a little bit different for everyone. For me, personally, I'm with you. I wanted to scream on the mountaintop, like, yo, this is amazing. Like, you can get better. Like if I can get better, and I spent 20 plus years of my life convinced I was irredeemable, well, I'm pretty sure you can get better too. And I want you to know that you can, that it's possible, that recovery is not only possible, but it's absolutely worth it. And I did that. So I recovered out loud, and that became a superpower for me. This thing that I ran from for decades, I finally surrendered to and embraced. And it became this incredible superpower for me. And I learned to recover out loud without having to name my specific program out loud. And now if you come to me one-on-one, I'm going to tell you all about it. I'm going to tell you exactly what program. I'm going to tell you exactly how I got better, right? Because that's the point, right? So I feel like if I recover out loud and I do my best to be the best example of recovery I can be on a daily basis in all facets of my life, whether you're looking or not, whether you're paying attention or not, then you might want what I have. And if you do, I'm going to tell you about it. I'm going to be real specific about it. And the idea of, you know, 12-step anonymous programs having these idols and messiahs, I don't think I like that either, right? I don't know that I would want, like, if Tom Cruise was jumping up on a couch and saying, AA saved my life. Like, I don't know. Maybe I don't want to be a part of that. You know, and so I color me grateful that, you know, there's not sort of, you know, celebrity superstars necessarily attaching their names to certain recovery programs, whether that be, you know, one of the 12-step programs or whether that be Smart Recovery or whether that be one of the other ones, right? So, like, you know, so that's kind of how I feel about it. I'm really passionate about recovering out loud. And then I'm one-on-one. If you want to know how I got better, I'm going to tell you.
You really don't think there are any celebrities attaching themselves?
No, there.
And I ask that because I'm thinking about Eminem showing up to the Grammys with a gigantic AA medallion around his neck. And I'm like, well, I think they're attaching.
And Jamie Lee Curtis, like, God bless her. I love her to pieces. She's an amazing human, but samesies.
Yeah, yeah. But I love that stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I, for me, it was such an incredible and proud moment, you know, when Eminem comes cruising out on the Grammy stage. Totally. I was like, hell yes, yes, you know. Totally. But I always had a weird thing too, where I felt like I was part of an exclusive club. I never thought AA was weird. I thought I was in the coolest place already, you know, which is probably just my narcissistic tendencies. But
of course, this is where the cool kids are.
Yeah, right. Naturally. Why else would I be there? Yeah. All right. So you've been sober since 2014. Indeed. Tell me a little bit about that December 5th. Tell me about the day before the first day.
Funny you should ask, Angela. There is a bit of a story behind
it. Imagine that.
Imagine.
Okay. I had a sneaking suspicion.
Indeed. Look, first time I drank, I was 15 years old. I loved it. It made me feel a way that I never thought possible. It eliminated all of the negative feelings that I didn't know what to do with. The anxiety, the depression, the fear. It unlocked things in me that prior to that moment, I was not able to unlock. I could stick up to the guys. I could flirt with the girls. I was the life of the party. I loved it. And all I wanted to do was feel like that again as soon as possible. And that's despite the fact that that night, the first time I drank and got drunk, I got so drunk that I became completely unmanageable, and they put me in a dog kennel outside to contain me, and then went to check on me a few hours later, and I was passed out, wasn't breathing, and my lips were blue. Now, I don't remember this because I was in a blackout. My friend somehow, my best friend, who's still my best friend today, managed to revive me, and then they fed me a bottle of syrup of Ipecac, and I proceeded to throw up in that dude's garage for hours, and still all I wanted to do was do it again. That was amazing. There were sort of two people too, and reacting to my, that was amazing, I want to do that again. There were the people like, you were a party god and you walk on water. And then there was the people that are like, you crazy, you almost died and you want to do that again. What's wrong with you? Now, those people I didn't have a lot of time for, but the people that worship me, like, I died and came back to life again, okay? You might be the quarterback of the football team, but I am a party legend, so I had serious party cred from that moment on. And really, Angela, for the next 20 years, I ran into two unmistakable truths. And this... By the way, I got sent to treatment by my parents right after that, and I'll never forget this. I'm chipping out at 28 days. I waxed poetically about recovery principles. I had no intention. It was like, but treatment at that time was like graduate school for budding addict and alcoholic, okay? You can get what now? Yes, please. I had no idea that was a thing, you know? So I just found out that there was more stuff that I could get. So I'm chipping out at 28 days, and everybody's telling me how wise I am and that I'm going to stay sober forever. And Eileen, the head treatment counselor, tough old Irish broad, I didn't even think she was paying attention, usurps the circle, grabs the coin, looks at me and says, you're lying to yourself. You're lying to this group. You're going to use again, and it's probably going to kill you. And she walked out. Everybody's like, what a bitch. I'm like, yeah, I know, right? But she was right, and I knew she was right. So every time my substance use became unmanageable, after that, Eileen would come back into my consciousness. You're lying to yourself. Lying to this group you're going to use again. It's probably going to kill you. And I, those two truths that I kept running into is that over any length of time, my substance use will become unmanageable. Could be an external consequence like a DWI. Got those. Could be an internal consequence. A deep, deep emotional bottom. Could be both. But it would become unmanageable. And then I would try to quit or moderate. And I would run into the other truth, which was over any length of time, I can't be sober by myself without a solution. Can't do it. I'll just explode. Like I just get really, really, really angry and tense, and little things just make me want to explode. And I have no choice but to go back to substances, because at least I don't want to like explode. So both of those things were unmanageable, and I would run into those truths alternating throughout that time. And it really culminated in I'm on the back end of a third marriage that I'm actively burning down. And my wife at the time looks at me one day and says, "You drink every day." Like, yeah, baby, but it's only a few. She's like, okay. Now she's counting. And the problem with trying to outsmart somebody that's A, already smarter than you and not drunk, don't work very well. But I'm doing my best. I'm like, I got a stash in the garage and I've got the fridge stash and I'm trying to do this rotation situation. If I only have three beers in the fridge at any one time, then that's a few, and then she won't figure it out. It took like a day and a half, and she's like, "That's way more than a few. I think you have a problem. I can quit anytime I want."
Famous last words.
She's like, "Sweet, do it." I'm like, "You know what? I should have seen that coming." So I quit for 30 days on Marlboros and resentments, which I don't recommend. And I was like, "See? Told you." And my oldest child's birthday and Thanksgiving fell on the same day that year. And I convinced her that it was cool. We should get some alcohol. My parents were coming over. We were going to have a little get together at the house. And so she's like, okay. I'm like, I'll go. I'll go to the liquor store. I got it. I got it, baby. I got enough liquor to get an army drunk. There was like four of us drinking. It didn't even make That made no rational sense. And I knew, and I didn't like to put myself in this box. I knew myself just well enough to know that I didn't like to promise other people or myself that I wasn't going to drink very much, because I knew myself just well enough to know that I can't predict when I'm going to stop once I start. I've demonstrated that to myself a million times. Once I start, all bets are off. But I knew how important this was to demonstrate that I could just have a few. And I wanted, with every fiber of my being, only to have a few. I didn't want to get divorced again. I didn't want to lose it all again. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. My parents get there. I take the first drink. The drink takes the second drink. Then the drink takes me. I'm out of control. I'm drinking half-drank wine that's not mine. I almost chop my hand off carving the turkey because I'm annihilated. And I'm having this out-of-body experience watching myself get annihilated, and I can't stop. And I want to with everything that I have. My parents leave, and she looks at me, and she's like, "What is wrong with you?" And she wasn't trying to be mean. She really wanted to know. And my oldest looks at her and looks at me and says, "What do you mean?" "It's just Dad. He's just drunk again." And that's when it hit me. I wasn't fooling nobody. Everybody knew I had a problem. She's like, "You got to go to treatment or it's over." So I went to treatment not because I wanted to get sober. I went to treatment because I was just trying not to get divorced again. Okay. And for some reason, when I got into that treatment counselor's office, I got honest for the first time in my entire life about everything. I wasn't planning on it. wasn't my goal, wasn't my intention, but I did. And I just think there was something inside of me that just knew the gig was up, and this was my opportunity to, for the first time in my life, get completely honest about the full scope and scale and nature of my substance use, my alcohol use, all of it. And that was the beginning.
What was your biggest fear about getting sober? Like, when you would think about living a sober life, like, obviously you did treatment, so you had a period of time without drinking, right? You quit for 30 days on resentments and Marlboros. So you had a taste of sobriety, right? Like, what was fearful for you when you thought about living your whole life that way?
Living with me? Living inside of my body? Unmedicated, unanesthetized. I demonstrated over and over that that became unmanageable for me, untenable for me. I didn't know how to live without them for any length of time successfully. And I didn't want to find out what that would be like. I didn't think life would be worth living. For the rest of my life without a way to be able to escape on the regular. It's the only way I knew how to be able to cope with living with me.
Yeah. How was your treatment different that time since you got honest?
Yeah. So it's interesting. She asked a question. She asked, what do you want to get out of this thing? After I got completely honest, I said, I want to know why I am the way I am. She laughed at me. She said, okay, let's say we figure it out. Let's say it's because you have big addict and alcoholic switches and they were bound to get tripped. Or let's say it's because your mom died when you were 11. Or let's say it's because it's a combination of the two. Do you think if you figure out why you are the way you are, you'll ever be able to drink normally again? Nope. Will you ever be able to use safely again? Nope. Cool. Should we figure out how we get better? Instead of why you are the way you are? And that was light bulb moment. Like, yes, please. Let's do that. I want to get better. I do. And now I've demonstrated without any doubt that my way didn't work. And that if I continue down that path, I'm going to destroy myself. No question. So I'm willing to try something different. And if that means that I don't drink, don't use, and try something different to see if that works, I'm willing to do that. And so I was open to suggestions. I think about that gift of desperation for me that happened in that treatment counselor's office, got completely honest, and that honesty provided just enough willingness and just enough humility to be able to say, yeah, I want to try something different. I'm willing to do that. And so I had this willingness to see if there was a different way than I had been living, and knowing full well everything that I had tried up to that moment got me there. So I'm willing to listen. And that was the key. And I started really listening to some people's stories. They thought like I thought, they drank like I drank, they felt like I felt, and they got better. Okay, maybe I can too. And then really two things in the beginning were transformational for me. Number one, so my now ex-wife, who hated my guts but loved me enough to stay married long enough to keep me on her amazing insurance so I could go to Hazelden for 6 months.
Well, that was a long time ago.
I'll never ever forget that. And she had Cadillac insurance, okay? So let's be real clear about that. Like, she had the best insurance you could get, okay? And I'll be forever grateful for her for allowing me to stay on that insurance for that long.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a lot of people that would have done that. She did. So
you used the phrase, the gift of desperation. There's a vast piece of my audience that will not understand what that means. I would love for you to break that down. It's one of my favorite terms.
Sure. The gift of desperation, G-O-D, is the letters of that acronym. And I truly view it as a gift because that gift of desperation allowed me to completely surrender to the fact that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become completely unmanageable. And I was willing to do whatever it took to get better, whatever it took. And I believe that to be an act of providence of my higher power that I had no relationship with at that moment. To be real clear, I hated God. I wanted nothing to do with God. Now I dressed it up in agnosticism, but I found out later in steps 4 and 5 that I had a big old resentment against God for taking my mom away. So that was that. But yeah, that gift of desperation, you know, my co-host, Jason Rudin, has a great saying, and you know, he learned it from somebody else. He was taken to the gates of death, given the gift of desperation, met a group of drunks, and given good orderly direction. And that's been my experience. And you know, Fred Holmquist does a great problem and solution presentation, and he does such a wonderful job of defining what my problem is, which is a problem that centers in my mind and in my body. I have an obsession, right, that drives me to drink. And then once I drink, I can't predict when I'm going to stop, right? So I have a two-part problem, right? This obsession of the mind and this allergy of the body. And then I have a solution. And the solution for me is working the 12 steps in order with a sponsor, along with EMDR therapy. And I did those in combination, and I will tell anybody who's willing to listen that that was the secret combination for me that unlocked my recovery. I really believe I needed to do both of those in parallel. EMDR therapy allowed me to move through some significant trauma. The 12 steps allowed me to really realign key relationships that were all twisted up. First, my relationship with myself, my relationship with my higher power, and then ultimately my relationship with other people. And I really view the 12 steps in that way, really reconnecting those relationships. I had a messed up relationship with my higher power. I hated God. I got to get that right. And then myself. And then ultimately other people. And as we know, connection is so important in recovery. Mm-hmm. But I can't really connect to you in a meaningful way, in an authentic way, if I'm all twisted up inside and I'm not right with myself, right? And so those relationships getting straightened out were just a complete game changer for me. And the 12 steps enabled that. But it would not have been possible for me if I didn't also embark on that EMDR therapeutic journey.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point that there often are more things needed, right? Like a lot of us need different types of support and therapies and healing. EMDR, for those of you listening that don't know what that is, it is a trauma therapy. It's eye movement desensitization reprocessing. It is fantastic. I'm curious, Charlie, when you did that, how long had you been sober before you delved into EMDR?
It's a great question. Not long, maybe 60 days, inside of even 60 days. It was pretty quick.
But you did it in the treatment environment?
I did.
Okay, yeah, that makes more sense.
You got it. And yeah, certainly I was stabilized.
And a super supportive community, right? You were in a good spot to be digging into some of that stuff. Yeah.
No question. And she was so good and so well trained in it and a really good fit for me, just from a therapist perspective. And I think all of that matters mm-hmm. in terms of it being effective. And we eased into it. We didn't just the first session jump into the trauma. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you know, she was very good at sort of getting comfortable with each other and with the EMDR piece. And then, you know, I think it was probably six sessions deep before we started even, you know, touching some of the trauma stuff. So she was very good at determining what the right pace was for me.
It's so different for everyone. You know, I mean, I was 13 years sober before I ever considered doing my own EMDR. And I don't really know why. I don't know that I necessarily had to wait that long. I don't know. It just, that's when it felt right. It's when I felt capable, because I think when you go into any specific therapy like EMDR, right, it is trauma therapy. And when you're going into something like that with that specificity, you do have to have a level of comfort with yourself, your own coping skills, your support system. You know, you have to feel prepared to start picking at some of those scabs. So you have to have some awareness of when that right time is for you, right? And it is different for everybody. And I only say that because I don't want somebody listening to this that is a month sober going, oh my gosh, maybe I need to go do EMDR therapy and that's going to be the thing that fixes me. Maybe that's going to be the thing that changes it all and I'll stay sober, because that's not the case, right? Like, you really have to be in a situation or be healthy enough yourself to deal with that stuff.
No question. And it takes what it takes for each person, to your point, Angela. And there's things that I'm addressing now, 9 years in, that I have not addressed up until now. Some other traumas. And I think to myself, why did I wait this long? Why? Because it was on my fourth and fifth, but then I just sort of moved on, I guess. But I think more it was I just wasn't ready yet to really.
Yeah.
And it's coming up. And right. It comes up when it comes up. And I don't think our bodies necessarily have this specific timeline. Like, so to your point, it's highly individualized and there's no one way to address trauma, especially in recovery. In my mind, to your point, it's really important to have a good support system around you when you start that process, good therapeutic fit. All of these things matter a lot in that process. And whether you do it, you know, earlier in your recovery journey or later, there's no right or wrong.
I'm curious if you had this experience too, because I feel like I've seen this a lot with my clients and have experienced it personally as well. Were there things that maybe felt different once you had been sober for a while, once you're in recovery for a period of time? I feel like there are things that we tend to minimize that later in the journey, you have a different understanding of like, oh gosh, maybe I need to deal with that. You know, where, and it could be anything, you know, it's certainly trauma stuff, but different life experiences where at one stage of recovery, I didn't think it was such a major deal. And then years later, I realize like, oh, wow, that was kind of a big deal. And I think I need to do some work around that.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. And I have these moments, not all the time, but on a somewhat regular basis, still 9 years into my recovery. And to your point, Angela, I'm interviewing somebody for the Way Out podcast. The episode's been released at this point. And the episode was all around relationship with food. And it had not occurred to me how tied in my relationship with food is to my mom, who died when I was 11 years old. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen watching her bake and cook, hoping to get like a spoonful of cookie dough or cake batter, and how emotionally wrapped up that is into my relationship with food and comfort. And I didn't, it makes sense. And if in retrospect, like, duh, you know,
I know I'm sitting here having a light bulb moment as you're saying that. I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah. I can see that. Food was my first addiction long before I ever had a drink. I mean, it was my family, like the connection and family gatherings, everything always revolved around food, especially my age, right? Where like my grandparents and parents, like everything was made from scratch. So cooking dinner and baking was a situation, you know, like this was a time consuming situation, and always connecting, always with my grandmother, always with my mother, and setting the table and doing the things, but like everything in one way or another revolved around food. And it was always a topic of conversation. And yeah, so it's fascinating. Like you're saying that, and I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, that's huge.
Absolutely. And how, just in general with humans, how wrapped up comfort is with food. It's the first source of comfort we get from our mothers in womb, is that. And then when you add in the layers, like you talked about, Angela, how wrapped up with family and love and connection and safety food is, no doubt. It's no wonder that many of us who wind up in recovery have all sorts of interesting relationships with food.
Yeah, no question. Interesting too, all of those words you used in talking about food can easily be interchangeable with alcohol, drugs, and all the other things.
All the safety, all the comfort.
Connection.
Yeah. You fun, got it, Angela.
Happiness.
My dad always used to say, Charlie, you had the quickest hand of the cookie jar. So I know for a fact.
Yes.
That. In fact, I got an additional little piece of context to that story. I'm having lunch with my dad the other day, and I was telling him that, you know, I always say that line when I'm sharing about my recovery journey, that, you know, Dad always said Charlie had the quickest hand of the cookie jar. He's like, no, seriously, you did. No, that was, yeah, no, really. That's not a joke. You did. He's like, we would.
He's like,
we would,
I know it's funny and all, but it's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But no, really. And we would hide the cookie jar like way up high. And he's like, you'd find it. And it doesn't matter where we put it. You were like three. And there's little Charlie like on the top of the refrigerator. So yes, mine too, Angela, was food.
Where would you say has been your biggest challenge in your sober life? And how did you overcome it without relapse?
Two, probably, biggest challenges for me. The first was when my oldest child transitioned from female or male to female. I moved out of the house. And I've never said this on a podcast before, so this is an exclusive.
Thank you.
Indeed. And you know, I didn't see it coming. That wouldn't be the first time I've been accused of not being necessarily the most perceptive human being on the planet. So nonetheless, I did not see that coming, Angela.
Yeah.
Okay. And she came out to me first, and I didn't know what to do with it, and it didn't make sense to me. It completely changed my entire understanding of how my oldest child, how she grew up. And I had to lean into literally every single recovery tool I had available to me in order to be able to process it and be able to still be there for my now daughter in a way that aligned with the person that I continue to aspire to be. And it was not easy.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to tell her that she's making a mistake, and that if you take XYZ hormones, they're going to affect you for the rest of your life and you won't be able to undo it. And they have other health risks that you can't undo. And all of this fear and all of this anxiety, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I was able to lean into my recovery peers and share where I was at and my higher power. And I say a lot, like most of what I work on these days, Angela, is letting go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that was for me. And I love the saying that anything an addict or an alcoholic lets go of has claw marks all over it.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my experience. I was able to, though, Angela, let go and understand the best thing that I could do was work on me. And that if I had a problem with my now daughter and their new identity, that's my problem. That's about me. That ain't about her. And I needed to let that go. And I needed to be the best example of recovery I could be and be there for her in a time that she needed it. And I was able to do that. And it was not easy for this, like, right in the middle of a Gen X / millennial kid. It was not easy. And I'm so grateful for it. I am so grateful. Today we have a beautiful, we just had lunch and I brought my recovery dog, Louie, and we had a walk, and like we have a beautiful relationship today, and it's 100% because of recovery.
Yeah.
And then the second piece was my first long-term relationship in recovery ended over the summer, 5 years. And this may surprise you or not, but I've been known to make women my higher power before.
I've heard rumor of such behavior.
And so that was extremely difficult. And
okay, wait. Now you have to explain that concept too. I mean, we think it's really funny, but yeah, right. I've talked about it on other episodes before briefly, but explain something, anything, not only a person, but it usually is a person. Explain making someone your higher power.
And I say that I still had my higher power and I still, but I use that person to solve a lot of my emotional needs.
And guiding decision-making.
You're right. Correct.
It, yeah.
Even if it's like, what am I going to eat for dinner tonight? You pick. Right. Like,
well,
whatever,
what are they
right?
doing? Yes, where are you going? I don't know. Where are they going?
Where are we going?
Right. Where are we going? Yeah.
Exactly. So a lot of my emotional needs were wrapped up in this relationship, which allowed me not to necessarily tend to my own emotional needs and not lean into my higher power. But most specifically, because I really did still maintain a spiritual practice. Most specifically, I don't need friends as much, right? I don't need, you know, to hang out with my recovery peeps as much. I've got a relationship. Why do I need you people? That's mostly what it is for me. Like, I don't need friends. I don't need any of that. I got a relationship. It's fine. But it's not. If it's all wrapped up into one person, that is not healthy, right? So that was a really big learning experience for me in recovery. Because prior to that, I certainly would make women my higher power. But when they would go away, I'd have drugs and alcohol would fill that void.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I was not using them, but still, like I had other stuff that I could turn to, namely drugs and alcohol, when relationships ended. And it still was like devastating, but at least I had the bottle. I did not have that this time, which was a blessing because it forced me to really lean into my recovery community in a way that I never have before and really be vulnerable in a way that I have never been before. And it's been magical.
Mm-hmm.
It's been freaking magical because I've got this recovery community in my home group and other really important people in my recovery because I intentionally made the decision to consistently reach out to people and ask how they're doing, but also tell them how I'm doing and be honest. Like if I'm not doing good, not just say good and be vulnerable. And I've got these relationships that would not have existed otherwise.
Right. It's so important to talk about these things too, because life doesn't stop happening just because we get sober, right? Like the life things are still going to happen. And we have to know that we can get through even the toughest things. Like we can get through it and stay sober at the same time.
No question. Life gets lifey.
Yes, it does.
It does. And we're not perfect in recovery. I'm certainly not. And that's one of the things that I really have leaned into of late, is being even more mindful of not trying to portray this like perfect recovery persona in veneer.
Yeah.
Which I'm really good at. Like I can wax poetic with the best of them and not tell you a thing about what's really going on.
It's an excellent distraction.
Indeed it is.
Okay, last question, favorite question. What is your favorite thing about being a sober person?
Oof. My favorite thing about being a sober person, about being in recovery, is my increasing ability to be able to show up in a meaningful way for the people that matter most.
That's powerful.
For myself, for my family, my kids, my friends, I can increasingly show up in a meaningful way and really be there for me when I need it and for you when you need it.
Yeah, I love that. Tell everybody where they can find you.
So you can find me at wayoutcast.com. That's wayoutcast, all one word, .com. That has all of the social links, as well as a link out to all of our amazing episodes. Again, wayoutcast.com.
And I will link that in the show notes for everybody so you can get there right from your favorite podcast app. Charlie, thank you so much. What a pleasure to get to know you. I really appreciate your time.
Angela, this has been an absolute blast, and I cannot wait to turn the tables very soon and have you on the Way Out podcast.
I'm ready.
Excellent.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast, candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.